Well, it's all right for him, swanning around in his chariot. Servants to pour cold water over his hands and fan the flies off his nose. What does he know about the back-breaking work of collecting straw? He's never done a hard day's work in his life. Well, good evening, brothers and sisters. It's to his eternal credit, isn't it, that there is no evidence at all of any kind of resentment on the part of Aaron against his brother Moses. And yet it's quite certain, isn't it, that for at least two-thirds of their lives, the experiences of these two men, brothers, were quite different. The one was whisked into the palace, pampered in an environment of wealth and luxury, and then plunged into the desert, a shepherd, largely, we imagine, in isolation. And the other laboured hard as part of a nation that was totally demoralised and depressed, largely given over to idolatry, and unable to raise its head, let alone its arm, against the Egyptian might. Moses and Aaron present us indeed with two very great contrasts. Perhaps we ought to go back and think first of all about the genealogy of these two men, and Aaron in particular, when it says that she bare him Moses and Aaron. And there you will be fairly familiar, I think, with the family tree of Aaron from Jacob through his son Levi. From the tribe of Levi, the family of Kohath, and from the family of Kohath, the house of Amram. And Amram married his aunt, Jochebed, and there were three children, Miriam, Aaron, and Moses, in that order. So that just sets the scene for us and reminds us of the background of Aaron, and of course of his older brother and sister. And we ought to notice one or two things about that little family, perhaps, before we go any further. Some have suggested that there may be some generations missing in that family tree. That perhaps Amram and Jochebed were not the immediate parents of Aaron or Moses and Miriam. That perhaps Amram and Jochebed should be further back in the line, and that there are other parents, immediate parents of Aaron, and other men and women in this genealogical line whose names we do not know. The New International Version suggests that fact for one. It's just the way it's known in our house. The difficulty, I think, and the reason that is sometimes suggested is to try and bring together two verses which do create a little bit of a problem. Would you like to turn back for a moment to Genesis 15? Where in verse 13, God promises Abraham something concerning his descendants. The verse reads like this. Genesis 15 and verse 13. And he said unto Abram, know the surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and they shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Now the NIV takes that 400 years as being the time that the people of Israel were in Egypt. And certainly this verse is capable of being read in that way. That the period of slavery of the nation of Israel lasted around about 400 years. Now, I'd suggest to you that that's not the right way to read it. If it is the right way to read it, then indeed the generations that we have there on the screen would not be sufficient to fill that period of time. Levi came down into Egypt. But the sons we have listed there, Levi, Kohath, Amram to Aaron, could not possibly have filled 430 years in Egypt. There is, however, another way in which this verse in Genesis 15 can be read, and this is the alternative that I'd like to put before you, and the one which for which I state my own personal preference. And that is to read Genesis 13 like this: "And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, bracket, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them, close the brackets, 400 years. So Abraham and his seed, or Abraham's seed particularly, would be strangers in a land that was not theirs for 400 years, but not necessarily Egypt. And the affliction of Israel and Israel's service under bondage was not necessarily to last 400 years. And I think it's perfectly fair to take the verse here in Genesis 15 in that way, with part of it being in parenthesis. Now that seems to be borne out if you will come to Exodus chapter 12. Here in Exodus chapter 12, we are assured, when Israel left Egypt, that it was exactly 430 years from the day in which God had spoken to Abram, presumably the words of Genesis 15. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 40 tells us, "Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day, it came to pass that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." Now those verses do not say that they were in Egypt and in bondage 430 years, but that it was 430 years to the day from when God had spoken to Abram that they left Egypt. And I'd suggest to you that the period of their bondage in Egypt was probably something slightly in excess of about 200 years. So, just to clarify that issue and to try and resolve the problem for any of you who might have been troubled by it or have become aware of it, and perhaps you haven't, here is a suggestion as to how those years might have worked out. And this is only a suggestion, and you might like to discuss this and talk about it afterwards. You might have other ideas that you want to propose. Abraham arrived in Canaan, remember, at the age of 75, and Isaac was born when Abraham was 100. So in the calculation of the 430 years, that 25 years there is material. In the 400 years mentioned in Genesis 15, you'd have to leave out that 25 years, because Genesis 15 and 13 was talking only about Abraham's seed. So you'd have to start with the birth of Isaac and adjust the other numbers here by five somewhere. Esau and Jacob were born when Isaac was 60. So there's another 60 years to add to the original 25. Jacob fled from his brother Esau and went to work for his uncle Laban when he was approximately 70. Not easy to identify exactly how old Jacob was, but he was certainly around about the 70 mark. That may surprise you. We think of Jacob usually as a young man, don't we? Deceiving his father Isaac and fleeing from Esau. But he was around the age of 70 already by that time. He served Laban for 7 years and found that he had been married to Leah when he was hoping for Rachel. So 7 years there. Levi was Leah's fourth son, you remember. Third son. So there's a little bit of speculation there. We'll assume that he was born around about 4 years, let's say, 4 or 5 years after the marriage, give or take a year or two. But Reuben, Simeon, Levi. Levi was the third son of Leah. We don't know how old Levi was when his son Kohath was born, but I've suggested that we say he was about 61, and I've suggested a similar age for when Amram was born to Kohath, say about 60, and for when Aaron was born to Amram. Now that is normally fairly late in life. A number of the patriarchs had their sons at around about the age of 40. So 60 is a little bit on the late side. Perhaps in the tribe of Levi they were late starters with their marriages and their families. But you can see that a precedent has been set, can't you? Jacob was clearly very late in getting married. Isaac was very late in starting his family. So there is a precedent in this line, isn't it? And these things often do, not always, not inevitably, but they frequently do run in families. So it's not impossible by any means that since Esau and Jacob were born when Isaac was 60, and Jacob certainly had no children until he was over 70, that these ages of 61, 60, and 60, which are speculation there for the births of Kohath, Amram, and Aaron, are not unreasonable. They're probably not far away from actual fact. We do know, as the bottom line says, that Aaron was 83 at the date of the Exodus, because Moses was 80 and Aaron was 3 years older. So Aaron was 83 at the Exodus, and you tot all those up and it comes to 430. So that does show how that there can quite easily be 430 years from the time that Genesis 15 and verse 13 was spoken to Abraham, from the time that Abraham came into the land of Canaan, to the time when Israel left Egypt under the hand of God. So I hope that clarifies little difficulty that, as I say, some of you may have been aware of, and shows how the record there is obviously right, and there's no need for the NIV or anyone else to suggest that there were intervening generations of whom we know nothing. I suggest that Israel were not in Egypt for 400 years, but something in excess of 200, and the total time from Abraham to the Exodus was 430 years. And that hence, the generations as we have them, and as we saw them and read them together there in Exodus 6, are absolutely correct as they stand. And Amram and Jochebed were the actual parents of Miriam, Aaron, and Moses. Now let's just think for a moment about the family itself. As we said, Miriam was the oldest. She was probably about 8 years old at the birth of Moses. And Aaron was presumably born before the dreadful edict of the Pharaoh, which condemned all further sons born to the Israelites to be thrown into the Nile. Since there's nothing about that in connection with Aaron, and since his parents do not seem to have had to make special arrangements for Aaron's safety and salvation, we assume that the Pharaoh's edict came after his birth, and that Aaron was born as a normal child and brought up in the normal way. He was 3 years old before there were any difficulties for the family. But by the time Moses came along, of course, the matter was very different. And certainly Moses, we know, was the victim of that edict, but for the faith of his parents. Let's just have a look at the verse in Hebrews 11. There's another verse in Acts 7 in Stephen's speech that we won't look at now. But Hebrews 11, we could just remind ourselves perhaps of how the writer here points to the faith of Moses' parents, and hence, of course, Aaron's parents too. Hebrews 11 and verse 23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, Revised Version, a goodly child, and it's the same word that Stephen uses in Acts 7, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. Now, that may not appear to tell us very much, but in fact it tells us a great deal, doesn't it? It tells us, brothers and sisters, what an immensely faithful family this was. Amram and Jochebed were apparently quite different from most of the people around them. Israel was steeped in idolatry at this time in Egypt. We sometimes forget that, but Ezekiel 20, and we won't turn to it just now, but Ezekiel 20 shows that Israel were an idolatrous people there in Egypt. And so we imagine that the faithful families, at least families with faith of this stature, were probably few and far between in the nation. But Hebrews 11, in making that catalogue of faithful men and women, pinpoints them especially. So Amram and Jochebed must have been extremely faithful in their little family. They were a God-fearing man and woman, standing out from those around them, separated even from their own brethren, who had sunk into the ways of the world about them, who had picked up the idolatry of Egypt, who had forgotten the promises that God had made to their forefathers. Amram and Jochebed in that kind of environment, brothers and sisters, not in a vacuum, but in a hostile environment, still held those promises made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob as very precious. So much so that they were prepared to risk their lives for them. They were not afraid, says Hebrews 11, of the king's commandment. So that's the kind of background into which Aaron was born and in which he grew up. He had extremely godly and faithful parents. And you can see that their faith was already brimming over into their family by the involvement of Miriam in the actions that they took to protect Moses. Miriam was only a little girl, but she was involved. The very fact that she was sent to keep watch over Moses must surely mean, when you really stop and reflect upon it, brothers and sisters, that they told her why. She knew, or she would have to know, to whom she was to speak and to whom she wasn't, more particularly. She would have to know what she was to say, and most especially what she was not to say. She would have to know who she was to watch for. So they had taken Miriam into their confidence, and to do that they must have told her something about their hopes, the preciousness of their faith, their belief, what God meant in their lives, and why they were doing this, and why they were risking their lives. And that's why it would be so vitally important that Miriam knew and understood her instructions and was keen to help the family in obeying those instructions, because the lives of all of them were at stake. So can you see how we have some information, don't we, about the kind of family we're dealing with? And even though Aaron would not be personally involved at this stage, at 3 years old, presumably, it does reflect on the kind of atmosphere into which he was born and in which he was brought up. Now, initially, Moses too would be brought up in that atmosphere, and because Moses' mother was chosen by the Pharaoh's daughter as the nursemaid of Moses, Moses and Aaron would presumably know one another and would spend some years together as brothers, would play together when they were small, and then would at some point, we don't know exactly when, but at some point they would be suddenly and cruelly parted. and from thence forward their lives for the next 70 years or so would take a very, very different line. So we have to speculate a little bit on their background, but it doesn't take a great deal of imagination, does it, brothers and sisters, to try and understand what was happening and how things worked out in those early years. So now we have to think about Aaron being without his brother and growing up, as we said, in totally different circumstances, subject to the rigors of slavery, the cruel bondage which Israel experienced, feeling the lash of the taskmaster's whip upon his back, knowing what it was like to be up from sunrise to sundown when his brother was way away, some miles distant in the palace, with servants at his disposal, all the trappings of royalty and of court life. And I think we would have been able to excuse him had there been some resentment of that, and perhaps within the nation there was, brothers and sisters, perhaps, just perhaps, this accounts for some of the reactions to Moses' leadership in later years. It's all right for him, you know, he had a sports car and whatever the equivalent was in those days. He had it good. He had everything made for him, didn't he, did Moses? And perhaps there would be some resentment among some of the Israelites. But as we said, there is no evidence at all that Aaron ever resented his brother or envied him. Well, what was Moses doing? Well, perhaps, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow evening, God willing, perhaps he was the family priest as the firstborn son. And perhaps he had special responsibilities in that regard. We can't be certain about that, but we'll talk about it again, God willing, tomorrow. Perhaps he had greater responsibilities than that. Perhaps he was not only a family priest, but in some way rose to a position of some authority and some importance within the nation of Israel. Whether that was so or not, we can be sure that at the age of 83, he had some great concerns for his brothers, for the burdens under which his people suffered and labored. I'd like you, if you will, to turn with me, please, to Exodus chapter 4. Seems to me, brothers and sisters, reading again between the lines, that Aaron must have been very anxious about the state of the nation, whether he had a responsibility in that regard or not. He was quite clearly, it seems to me, anxious about how his brethren felt and all that they suffered, and he must therefore, being a man from that godly family that we have considered, he must therefore have prayed about that, mustn't he? Doesn't that almost go without saying? With parents like Amram and Jochebed, would they not have brought him up and taught him to pray? As faithful and as godly as they were, can we doubt that Aaron was well schooled in the matters of God, in the matters of the law, in the matter of the promises that God had made, and the hopes and aspirations that Amram and Jochebed still held in their hearts for Moses? They saw him as a proper child, a goodly child. They knew that they had saved him for a particular reason, and they still pinned their hopes on God's use of Moses at some stage, even if that hope wavered at times. Generally, brothers and sisters, it must have remained firm. So we may not be very wide of the mark to imagine Aaron praying earnestly for God's help with the suffering and the bondage of Egypt. Exodus 4 and verse 14, then, it seems to me fits into that context. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses because God had appeared to Moses and instructed him to go back and lead the children of Israel out of Egypt, and five times, no less than five times, Moses had refused. Four times he had made reasonably well thought out excuses, and the fifth time he'd said, look, just send somebody else. And so, not surprisingly, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well, and also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee, and when he seeth thee, he will be glad in his heart. There's a lot in that verse, brothers and sisters, and we just want to break it down and examine it in a little bit more detail. Surely, God must have spoken to Aaron before this. Because God says to Moses, Aaron thy brother cometh forth to meet thee. Now it's possible, I know, that God is speaking of things which are to be as though they already were, to quote the phrase from Romans. That Aaron was not actually on his way at this stage, but God knew he would be very shortly. I think, however, it's more likely that God had already spoken to Aaron, and Aaron had already set off. And if he had, well, it must have been that God had spoken to him. No man would have set off for the wilderness and Midian without knowing that there was at least some possibility that he could find Moses. You'd be a lunatic to hope that you just might happen to meet Moses somewhere in the region of Mount Sinai, wouldn't you? This was a wilderness. This would be worse than looking for a needle in a haystack, brothers and sisters. Aaron cannot have set off from Egypt without some direction from God. And that also surely intimates that he'd been praying, therefore, and God had answered his prayer. That it was by God's direction is actually confirmed when we come down to verse 27. Exodus 4 and verse 27, and the Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. And he went and met him in the Mount of God and kissed him. So God did actually speak to Aaron at whatever stage it was. And we suspect, as we said, that it was the result of prayer. And before God spoke to Moses, that Aaron was commanded by God and set off for the wilderness. Verse 14 of this chapter is actually the first mention of Aaron in the scriptures. And already, you see, he's 83 years old. Or possibly 82. He's already a grown man. There are 2/3 of his life of which we are not told anything at all. Background that we've tried perhaps rather feebly just to fill in, to give us some grasp of the character of this man. This is the first mention. And notice what else verse 14 says of Exodus 4. Is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well. That's interesting, isn't it? How did God know that? Well, of course, God knows everything. I understand that, brothers and sisters. But doesn't the phrase suggest that there was some experience of Aaron speaking well? God isn't just saying, oh, I know he would be able to speak well if ever he opened his mouth. God is saying, I know that he can speak well. There is some evidence of this that God has seen. Even though God knows everything and doesn't need evidence and knows the end from the beginning, surely this phrase is telling us that Aaron was already a good speaker. He was articulate. Is that telling us then that Moses, as we said earlier, held a position of some importance and some responsibility in the nation? Could he have been perhaps a sort of trade union leader, as it were? Not that I'm in favour of trade unions, you understand, but that perhaps Aaron was a sort of spokesman for the brick-making federation of Israel in front of Pharaoh. It does seem, doesn't it, that Moses might have had that Aaron might have had some particular responsibilities on behalf of the nation. For example, when Moses and Aaron actually return to Egypt, the first thing they do is they call together the elders of the nation. Now that again must suggest that they knew Aaron. Otherwise, why would they come together? Why should they hearken to Aaron? Who's Aaron? Aaron says we've got to come together. Who's Aaron? What do we come together for him for? If you went into the town of Scarborough and said, John Roberts says you've all got to come together, I can tell you nothing would happen. So this again seems to indicate, doesn't it, that Aaron was known. He was a man of renown. Now, it's not because he's a Levite. The tribe of Levi isn't especially renowned at this time, so far as we know. The tribe of Levi was chosen later, wasn't it, because of its action in the wilderness at the occasion of the golden calf, which we shall be looking at a little later this week, God willing. So maybe again we are being told here that Aaron was a man of importance, a leader of the people of some sort, perhaps an elder himself within his family, and certainly sympathetic towards his brethren. So that at verse 29 of chapter 4, when he calls the elders together, and Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel, and Aaron spake all the words which the Lord had spoken unto Moses, and did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. He was listened to. He was taken notice of. They knew that Aaron was on their side. And perhaps, brothers and sisters, despite the fact that we have suggested that the majority of the nation was idolatrous at this time, perhaps they had some admiration for the faith of Aaron, for his godly character and conduct. Perhaps his family was respected and admired because they clung still to the promises that God had made and put their confidence in them. Perhaps Aaron not only spoke to Pharaoh on behalf of the nation, but spoke to the nation on the behalf of his own faith, and maybe even on behalf of God. And perhaps also Aaron may already have approached Pharaoh. Come back to chapter 3, verse 9. Someone had been speaking to God about Israel, and Aaron seems as likely a candidate as anyone. Chapter 3 and verse 9, God says, "Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them." There are two separate things there, brothers and sisters, aren't there? It's not just the cry of the oppression that had come up. Someone had been praying. God had heard the cry of the children of Israel. Not just their oppression and their burdens. Seems to me that perhaps Aaron had been the one making his prayers on behalf of himself and his family and perhaps a wider circle of people than that. And maybe he had already approached Pharaoh and found the situation to be hopeless and knew that they needed someone else. And like Barnabas, seeking Saul of Tarsus for a particular work, perhaps Aaron recognized that Moses was just the man for this job, and surely God had chosen him as the man for this job. And in that spirit, and with the command of God himself, Aaron had set out to find his brother. That might even be suggested again by verse 14 of chapter 4. Did you notice the other phrase there? "I know that he can speak well, and also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee, and when he seeth thee, he will be glad in his heart." That's lovely, isn't it, really? He would be glad. No resentment at all, you see. No envy whatsoever. Aaron would be glad to see Moses because he understood that Moses would be just the man for this job which God had in mind for him. Doesn't that then tell us what a man of faith Aaron was? And not only faith, but obedience too. that when God said to him, at whatever stage it was, the words that we have read from verse 27 of Exodus 4, the Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses, he set off. Impossible task though that must have sounded to be, Aaron went nonetheless. He went in faith, and he went in obedience to the command of God. So the picture we have to build up of Aaron, brothers and sisters, is of a very godly and faithful background within his family, and a faithful and obedient man himself, who possibly, maybe even probably, held some position of importance and of renown already within the nation, largely as the result of his faith and his prayer and his confidence in the promises of God. When he seeth thee, he will be glad. What a lot the two men would have to talk about, wouldn't they? How quickly that long journey on foot back from Horeb into Egypt must have passed. They had so much to tell each other, so much to talk about. Moses had married in the meantime. And perhaps also Aaron too. At some point, and we don't know exactly when, Aaron did marry. He married a very faithful woman again, this time from the tribe of Judah. And I've put this slide on the screen just because I think it bears out what we were saying about the generations of Levi and Kohath and Amram to Aaron, being perhaps late starters, for want of a better phrase. Because if you notice, whereas Amram married his auntie, so he also was a young man marrying an older lady, Aaron is the third generation from Levi, whereas his wife, Elisheba, is the fifth generation from Judah, Levi's brother. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. Levi and Judah were pretty much of an age, maybe a couple of years between them, that's all. And yet you can see, can't you, how there were five generations in the line of Judah to Aaron's wife, and only three in Aaron's. So that rather supports, I think, what we were saying earlier when we looked at that chart of the 430 years and suggested that maybe they started their families at around the age of 60-ish. Well, whenever it was, Aaron married Elisheba, and they had four children, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. And God willing, we shall meet some of them this week also. For this evening, just by way of conclusion, let's look finally at a couple of other verses in chapter 4 of Exodus, verse 16, where Aaron is designated by God as the spokesman for Moses. God, continuing to speak to Moses, says of Aaron, "And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people. And he shall be, even he shall be to thee, instead of a mouth, and thou shalt be to him instead of God." And so indeed it is in this chapter. Verse 29 and 30 we've already read. How that Moses and Aaron went and gathered the people, and verse 30, Aaron spake all the words which the Lord had spoken unto Moses, and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, and that he had looked upon their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshipped. So that's what Aaron was. He was a mouthpiece for Moses. Chapter 7 and verse 1 just puts that slightly differently. Exodus 7 and the first verse says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, See, I have made thee a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron thy brother shall be thy prophet." And I think that's helpful, isn't it? It just confirms for us what a prophet actually is. Aaron was to be a spokesman or a mouthpiece for Moses. Moses was to be to Pharaoh a god, and Aaron Moses' prophet. So that's what a prophet is. There's one of the Bible's definitions of a prophet, a mouthpiece for the word of God, a spokesperson on behalf of God. And that's the role here that Aaron fulfills. God has chosen Aaron to be, as it were, the mouth of God before Pharaoh. Again, brothers and sisters, doesn't that point to the faithfulness of this man? So although we don't know very much about him in those first 83 years, and the record is largely silent as to what was going on and what was happening, we do have, it seems to me, a fair bit of information that's very favourable in terms of the kind of family that Aaron came from and the kind of man that Aaron actually was. Exodus chapter 6, a portion of which we read together earlier, tells us that these are the genealogies, the names of the sons of Israel. And it takes us into the line of Levi, and that's as far as it goes. The purpose of the record here at the end of Exodus 6 is simply to introduce us to Aaron and to Moses. So, Exodus 6 and verse 23, we have read together, Aaron took him, Elisheba, daughter of Aminadab, sister of Nahshon, to wife, and she bare him, as we said, Nadab and Abihu, and Eleazar and Ithamar. And then it says at verse 26, these are that Aaron and Moses, to whom the Lord said, bring out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt, according to their armies. These are they which spake to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring out the children of Israel from Egypt. These are that, Moses and Aaron. Now I'd like to leave you with a question and a challenge. What is the record saying here? Twice it says, these are that, Moses and Aaron. And the New Testament picks up that same phrase and uses it, that rather odd phrase, it seems to me. Why does it have to say these are that Moses and Aaron? Were there other brothers called Moses and Aaron? Seems fairly unlikely, doesn't it, that there would be another two brothers with the same names. These are that Moses and Aaron. What is the record conveying by that expression? Do you suppose? Is it saying, these are that Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord spake, to whom the Lord said, bring out the children of Israel, these are they which spake to Pharaoh? Is it saying, these are that Moses and Aaron that had the strength of mind, the courage, the confidence to do as God said, to speak with Pharaoh? Is that what it's saying, that it's that Moses and Aaron? Surely there can't be any confusion over which Moses and Aaron it is. So is the record just pinpointing for us the immensity of what they did in their willing obedience to the word of God? Well, I leave that with you to think about. God willing, we'll pick up the story tomorrow.